You're gonna make the room dizzy, Chris. There it is. It's the default view.
Ready to move forward?
Yes.
I knew you were going to say that. I brought my script, but they knew I probably would forget it, so they put another one on my table. Anyway, I already heard it's being recorded. Turn on the green light. Announcement by the committee chair on the procedures for tonight's meeting. The May 16th, 22 Finance and Administration Committee meeting will now begin. This meeting is being conducted in person at the Rio Vista Water Treatment Plant boardroom. As a convenience to the public, members of the public may alternatively participate remotely by using the toll-free number and call in or the Zoom web kit provided by the committee package, which is posted on SCB website. In the event there is a disruption of service which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public and is not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meetings in person. Public comment during item two will be taken for items that are not on tonight's agenda, but are within the subject matter jurisdiction of the agency. For items covered in this agenda, we will take public comments at each time the item is considered. For members of the public who are present and would like to comment, please complete and submit a public comment card to the administrator to help expedite the process. Who's our administrator? Miss Erica. Okay. Members of the public who are present would like to comment to the administrator. To participate in public comment from a computer, tablet, or smartphone, please click the raise your hand feature in Zoom when I announce the agenda item on which you wish to speak. You will be notified when it is your turn to speak, at which time you may unmute your device. To participate in public comment via phone, please dial 9 when announced, when I announce the agenda item on which you wish to speak. Phone participants will be called on by the last two digits of their phone number or by name. When it is your turn to speak, please dial 6 to unmute. As a member of the staff, as a reminder to staff who are present online, please mute all devices until you are ready to speak. When speaking, please turn on your camera and or unmute your microphone. When you're finished presenting your item, please remute your microphone and turn off your camera. Do we get extra credit for reading the book? The procedures for tonight's meetings are as follows. I will introduce the agenda item. Staff will present. I will ask for public comments first from the members attending in person and then those attending remotely. I will then ask for discussion and questions from the committee members. These will be taken in the order hands are raised. The committee then comes to a consensus and moves for the item for the board's consideration. Note to the chair, please consider putting the items on a consent calendar when possible. I like that part. Any PowerPoint presentation shown on tonight's meeting will be posted on the SCB website. If there's no questions, we'll move on to the agenda for item one.
Yes, we do not have any public comment at this time.
Well, sorry. Item one is the Pledge of Allegiance.
Sorry for skipping ahead.
Mr. Colley, would you be kind enough to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And to the Republic
for which it stands,
one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, now we'll move in item two. Still no public comment?
No public comment at this time.
All right, item three presented by Rochelle Patterson. Recommend approval of a resolution adopting the appropriation of all as yet unappropriated funds for the year ending 21-22.
So really quick presentation. So pursuant to Article 13B of the California Constitution, the agency must appropriate all as yet unappropriated funds each year prior to June 30th. Contributions to any fund, to the extent that such contributions are derived from the proceeds of taxes, constitute appropriations subject to limitation in the year of contribution. This is a legal formality to ensure that no funds of the agency are unappropriated and thereby subject to forfeiture. The recommendation is that the Finance and Administration Committee recommends to the Board of Directors to adopt the attached resolution appropriating all as of yet unappropriated funds for fiscal year 21-22. Concludes my report.
Any questions? Any public comment?
We do have public comment. Cam Noltenmeyer.
Cam Noltenmeyer. Yes, I've been following this water company for a long time. And I'm just wondering here, this is unappropriated funds. Are any of that going to pay the debt that you have? You have a huge debt. And you just seem to keep rolling that along and getting bigger and bigger. Why isn't that being paid off with the unappropriated at this time? I would like an answer to that because I've been following this agency for years. And for some reason, that debt never seems to get paid. It just keeps growing. And if you can answer that, I'd appreciate it. And so I don't have to do public records requests. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. I believe the answer is available if you call the office and talk to finance, which would be Rochelle, I believe. Thank you. Item four, presented by Rochelle Patterson, recommend.
Questions from the board? Is it going on consent?
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. Was there any board question, any committee member questions?
I have no questions. I move we... Well, I'm okay with putting on a consent.
Okay. Yeah, 2-3 for consent. Thank you. Item four, presented by Rochelle Patterson. Recommend approval of a resolution adopting the appropriation limit for the 22-23 tax year or business year.
Yes, so the appropriation limit applies to taxes which are not specifically approved by voters. Therefore, the appropriation limit includes the agency's 1% property tax revenue, but does not include its state water project tax revenues. The limit for each year is equal to the limit for the prior year, adjusted for changes, and those changes are cost of living and population and various other adjustments. As shown in the committee memo, the appropriation limit for fiscal year 21-22 was almost 50 million or 48 million. Using the required calculation, taking into account the change in per capita income and change in population, the fiscal year 22-23 GAN appropriations limit is $51,330,990. The 1% property tax estimated for fiscal year 22-23 is $30,244,543, which is under the limit by $21,086,447. The recommendation is that the Finance Administration Committee recommends to the Board of Directors to approve a resolution adopting the appropriations limit for fiscal year 22-23. That concludes my report.
Great. Do we have any...
We are not showing any public comment at this time.
Any discussion from the committee?
No questions. I'm okay with consent.
All right. You've got a consent item. You're ready to go. So item five.
So item five is fleet management policy, which is employee manual policy number 41. So when it comes to asset management, the use of technologies and electronic devices such as fleet information systems and telematic devices are widely held as best practice for private and public fleets. In order to improve the management of the agency's fleet of 250 plus vehicles and equipment, staff is recommending the use of electronic devices to collect, analyze, and store asset data. So we have here today Jesus Ramirez. He's our fleet and warehousing supervisor. He's going to go through the presentation, and then I will go through the policy once he has completed.
All right. Good evening, everybody. We have a short presentation that's going to be focusing on three main things. The first one is that the use of telematics is a best practice. The second one is that the collection of data is a necessity in order to comply with new regulations. And three, that the purpose of this technology and this policy is to collect asset performance data and location and not to track individual employees. So we'll get started. Next slide, please. So why is telematics needed? It's really best practice for asset management. It's really designed so that we can collect data and make data-driven decisions about managing our vehicles, deciding when to replace them, how to allocate them based on their use, how to control costs. It's also, again, designed to automate regulatory compliance when it comes to emissions, as well as to make sure that we are complying with regulations in terms of use. It's also designed to improve maintenance so that we are able to know when a vehicle has an issue. It's also going to help us reduce risk as well as enhance safety so that we design training for our operators. And again, it's really designed to manage costs when it comes to fueling, idling, and repairs. Next slide, please. So how do these devices work? As you can see, there's a photo of the device. It really just goes into the diagnostics ports on the vehicle, and they communicate data as far as how that vehicle is performing. And so it tracks the asset performance as well as the location, and this is how we're able to collect that information. It would show trip information, how much it's idling, how fast it's driving, and then also, importantly, it's going to let us know if there's any issues with the vehicles. So that's how the devices work. Next slide, please. Who is using telematics? So this slide just shows a list of some of the agencies that are using telematics from the state contract. So the biggest user, I would say, is the state of California. They mandated and they had a deadline for all of their vehicles to have these devices as of February of this year. So some other agencies include the city of Santa Clarita, as well as other water agencies. So as you can see, this is widely used across the public and also private fleet as well. Next slide, please. When we were researching this topic, we reached out to other public agencies and requested their feedback as far as how they implemented the technology, as well as what experience they had. Again, they all mentioned that the benefits outweigh any potential concerns or pushback that they received. All of them did have experienced some pushback initially that fades away. It really comes down to education of the operator so that they understand how the technology works, what it's collecting, and once they see how it works, they're actually more comfortable. most importantly, the operators tend to actually see the value of the technology, especially when it exonerates them whenever any questions come up. Also, every agency that we spoke to had examples of how the technology has protected them from potential claims from the public or potential lawsuits as well. Once you have the data, it's pretty clear and cut if, you know, if a vehicle was at fault or not. We have also heard that there's a lot of savings that agencies experience. And pretty much what it comes down to is you can't manage what you don't measure, right? So once you start measuring, you're able to actually tailor solutions and control your cost. And the biggest thing that we heard was also that they recommend transparency when it comes to deploying this technology, as far as communicating with your operators and letting them know how you're using the technology, why you're using it, and keeping an open dialogue with them to get their feedback. Next slide, please. So here are some of the potential uses we've identified for the data. It really is focused on asset management, but there's more that you can do with that data. You could also design routes. It also helps with emergency preparedness, deploying assets, again, improving safety, also for sustainability purposes, reporting greenhouse emissions, and also very importantly, it allows or it makes agency more competitive when it comes to grants. Next slide, please. So here is our plan as far as rolling out the technology. Once a policy is adopted, we would notify the drivers that the agency will be implementing this technology. We will show them what data is going to be collected and answer any of their concerns. We would also use a state contract to procure the devices, and we would use the technology to integrate with our fleet management system. And again, this is an ongoing process, right? So we would continuously collect the driver's feedback and incorporate that as we move along with the technology. Next slide, please. So again, why did we select this vendor and these devices is because they have over 2,000 clients. When it comes to the government sector, it's available on the state contract. There is no additional cost for future upgrades as the technology changes. There's also the ability to cancel the contract at any time. And most importantly, they have high cybersecurity standards because they have contracts with Homeland Security and the federal government. So next slide, please. So as I mentioned, the three things we want to keep as far as this discussion is that one, this is a best practice. Two, this is a necessary thing for regulatory compliance. And three, the technology is designed to collect asset performance data, not driver data. So we're available for any questions.
Thank you very much. Nice presentation. Any questions for the public?
We do not have any public comment at this time.
Committee members? Director Colley.
Just a little bit curious, the mention of the cameras came up kind of late in your presentation. Will we be installing cameras?
No, not at this time. This is solely focused on the telematics devices. We have spoken with other agencies that they are looking into this. I would say they are widely used in the private sector. In the public sector, they're not as widely used. So that is something we'll look at in the future, but not at this time. Good question.
And if we were looking at cameras, are we looking at forward-facing cameras or cameras aimed at drivers?
Those are some of the things that we'll have to look at as we look further into this, and then also what sort of questions may come up with that. The cameras that are available right now are smart enough where you can turn off the recording inside the cab, but the sensors are still active. So that is what some of our other fellow agencies have done, turn off the recording inside the vehicle, keep the sensors on, and keep the recording looking forward or outside of the vehicle. So,
okay, and then, so I understand the collecting data on the vehicles and where the vehicles are going and how fast and all that. Is this data available to line managers?
So the way that the data will be used will be based on roles, right, of the agency. So, you know, we'll be running reports and then we'll be making those reports available to the departments as well as the managers and also the supervisors as needed based on, you know, to help them as they look into route planning. But then also if any issues come up, that data will be shared with them. So,
okay. So what I'm kind of wondering about is, so manager Bill wants to check and see if all of his people are taking 5 minutes too long for lunch. So he asked for all the data for his utility workers. Is that something he's going to be able to do? Is that it sounds like we're looking at vehicle maintenance and that sort of thing for this data, but I'm just somewhat concerned, as I think employees would be, as to the big brother aspect of this.
Yeah, and I would say those are, you know, concerns that operators, right, at other agencies have shared as well. And we'll be very transparent with our employees, letting them know that the purpose of this technology is not to track them, right? And, right, we won't know specifically, right, which drivers are using that vehicle in real time. But if an issue does come up, we will have enough information to find out, hey, who was driving that vehicle. So most of our vehicles are used by a single operator, but there are times where, you know, an operator will jump in another vehicle if theirs is not available or if they just need to use a different vehicle. So again, we're not necessarily tracking the individuals, right, because of that. We're tracking those assets, but we can, if an issue does come up, we'll be able to kind of identify those issues. And then again, it's not meant to track the, right, how, you know, how long they're there, or, you know, how long they take at lunch. It's mostly for the asset management aspect of it.
Okay. I understand the purpose, and I have no difficulty with that. I'm just trying to figure out if the data, if an employee would have a legitimate concern that it could be used in a way that you're telling me it's not intended to be used. So data oftentimes is intended for something, and then somebody says, "Oh, I can, you know, I can check on all my people. I can go and look at this computer, and I can tell whether or not they're taking 5 minutes too long for lunch, and I can create an issue where, lacking the data, maybe there would not have been an issue." So certainly, I understand that. An issue comes up, somebody in the public says, you know, so-and-so was speeding and on truck number 5 in Newhall and at noon. And it turns out the truck number 5 was in Canyon Country at noon and, you know, it was parked. So I understand that might be a use for the data, but I'm trying to figure out for the unintended use of the data, what is possible.
So yeah, I don't think the data, all of that data will be reported to the managers unless there's a question. So I guess the question is, and it would have to go through the general manager and through the fleet and warehousing supervisor for those requests.
Okay, I guess I'd like to make sure that we make it very clear that if the data is going to be requested by line managers, by lower level managers, that there be a higher level manager ensuring that there's a good, I guess my real concern, I think the employee's concern would be line managers just going on fishing expeditions, okay? Now, if there's reason to believe that employee Joe, his productivity is off and there's, we seem to, and we need to look at employee Joe. Okay. And so a higher level manager may well approve of looking at that data and finding out that yes, indeed we have, you know, the vehicle parked at McDonald's for 4 hours a day.
Yeah. Director Carley, if I may, you're asking the good questions there, and I think that's why we've included this as part of a employee manual, and Rochelle has more details on that when we get to her section of this discussion.
Okay.
I was just going to add in the policy that it does say that the Fleetmore Housing Supervisor or designated employee is responsible for generating monthly use reports in all agency vehicles and distributing the reports to management for review. So I don't think it would go to a line supervisor or to anyone else. And I'm sure that even some of that data is not even collected, it's just stored. So the data that that we're trying to collect is more for the asset and not necessarily for looking for disciplinary action.
Right. I want to be able to ensure our employees that the data, that it's the board's policy that this data will not be used for a fishing expedition. That's really and I think that's what an employee legitimately wants. When we're concerned about Big Brother, we want Big Brother to use technology to catch real honest to God criminals, but we don't want Big Brother watching our every move and trying to, every time we, I met my wife for lunch. We took a little extra time, it was over 5 minutes, happened on my anniversary, come on. We don't want that kind of a fishing expedition. And so I would like to make sure that as a board policy, we can assure our employees that that will not happen. Not that it's not what the intent is, but it will not happen. Does that make sense?
Right. You can address that with legal to get the appropriate language that we could add to the policy.
All right, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Director Martin.
Thank you, Chair Kelly. I'm following along Director Colley's questions, and I have a similar concern. So my question, I'm pretty sure I know the answer. Is there any personal use of agency vehicles allowed by those that are driving them at any time?
Well, when they're on the clock, personal use could just be eating lunch, driving through drive-thru, but when they leave for the day, no, they're meant to go home and not do any personal business.
And that's just a reasonable use during the lunch hour.
Right.
So I agree with Director Colley. Somehow we need to protect the policy from abuse by reasons that are not really the point of the policy, but it's going to be tricky to write that in because I know you've written into the policy that the employees have no right of privacy, no expectation of privacy while using agency vehicles. So kind of a delicate line but I do trust our personnel. I trust our management, but I understand Director Colley's concern and I would agree with it. Another question, it's stated in the staff reports that one of the uses is to defend against some sort of an accusation of by a member of the public or in a traffic incident or something like that. Has this technology stood up in court as valid defense for that? Do we know that? And I was almost expecting Attorney Colley to ask that question, but he did not. So I'll ask him.
Yeah, I'm not sure unless Jesus is about standing up in court, but I know there has been times here, like there's a camera at, and there has been an incident in the parking lot that is submitted to insurance to prove our fault or not at fault. But I'm not sure about it in a court of law or if it's just with the, insurance or not.
Okay. Yeah, and I would say it's usually not the only piece of evidence, right? But it is usually one of the pieces of evidence that, the agencies have used to defend themselves. And it's usually in those instances, right, where it's usually a false claim, right? And as soon as that other parties know that there is data behind that kind of, dissuades from any, taking the issue any further. So, but yes, it's used as part of evidence. So.
Thank you. I kind of would ask you to speak more into the microphone, if you don't mind. Yeah. I going to ask next? Is any of this information made available to the public?
Well, it is, would be part of our, yes, it would be.
For instance, if an employee is, if for some reason, a member of the public wants to track an employee's movements during the day, they can request that?
I don't believe they can request that, but they could request vehicle records. It would be part of our okay. public records request.
Right.
That would be an attorney question, but I think if it has to do with personnel and personnel records, that is not disclosable.
I don't think it would be bad to at least get an opinion as to whether it becomes a public record item. So maybe you could follow up on that for us. Anything else, Mr. Martin?
One more question. In the summary of attributes, I'll say, of the device and the technology, that they've witnessed a 10% plus savings in fuel cost. What do you ascribe? What do you think the reason for that is? I'll just let you answer that.
Yeah, very simply, it just comes down to being able to measure, right? Once you can measure, right, the performance of the asset, you're able to benchmark against yourself and other agencies. So, you know, typically we have vehicles that are alike, right? So if we see something unusual going on, right, that you're able to address those things. A big thing could be the operator, right? They may be idling potentially more than they have to, or it could also be the asset itself, right? Maybe it has underinflated tires, or it may have an issue, right, that's causing it to burn more fuel. So that's usually what it comes down to. It's just being able to pinpoint where the outliers are. So, and then also savings and maintenance, right? Because you're able to know as soon as a check engine light goes on, you're notified immediately. So you're able to address issues in real time.
Okay. I probably have one more question though. Is this a subscription program with the provider of the software, or is this something we just buy the hardware and then we operate it amongst the staff and there's no need for a subscription?
It is used kind of a subscription basis on a monthly cost, right, per vehicle. And it's mostly because of the cellular data, right? That's where the charge, most of the charges come from. So
did I read $60,000?
Yeah. And that would be right if all of our assets, if we install them. But then also we would see savings because now we don't have to take our vehicles to get smog or get a smoke test for diesel vehicles. So we would see savings there too, because the data automatically gets reported to the state and then they know that we would pass smog. So it would be $60,000 right in the red cost, but we would also see some savings. So that's what we'll use the pilot for, to see is what is the true cost ultimately of that. So
at today's fuel cost, the 10% savings might just pay for that.
So. Yes, it would.
I have no problem with moving it forward. I just think we need to be careful. Do whatever we can to prevent abuse of our people. If there's a person on staff that has an intention to do that, I just hope we can tailor the policy a little more to protect against that.
Great. I had one question, may have already been answered indirectly, but the data, it's not stored in the vehicle. It's remoted out to someplace at the agency.
That is correct. So the little device, right, collects the data and then uses a cellular service to communicate with the database. And that database is stored by the vendor. And that's where they have those high cybersecurity clearances to maintain the data. And then we have access to that data. And that data will then be imported into our fleet management system. And that's how we would kind of manage that data.
And will we do that daily, weekly?
The data would be imported in real time, and then we would, as far as the reporting, we would be running monthly reports, but then also, you know, periodically we'll look at the assets to see if there's any issues with them.
So when it comes to our safety report, something like this might show up in our, when we have a safety report meeting. Okay, so we can kind of keep track on some of the issues or some of the non-issues as time goes on. Okay, great. So any complications with consent calendar on this? Just a yes.
Yeah, or I don't. Second. I don't think it can go on consent, but I think it goes forward.
Okay, so we'll move it forward, not on consent. And thank you very much. Great presentation. I don't know if we'll see you tomorrow at the board meeting, or if you're going to pawn it back on to Rochelle.
Thank you.
So I know that Mr. Campbell's been feeling a little rejected because your name hasn't come up, but now you're on stage. So if you'd go ahead and take item six for us, do we have any public comment?
Sure thing.
Public comment for, we do not have any public comment at this time.
Okay.
Great. Well, if I may begin then, what I've got for you tonight is a brief introductory presentation. Are we okay?
She was just wondering why I confused her and moved public comment up one spot.
That's correct.
Just got to keep you on, got to keep you on your toes, Mr. Campbell.
All right. So the topic here at hand is establishing a Valencia service area retail capacity fee. And this item came up, remember the last time that we met here at the FNA committee, we were talking about budget, and it was mentioned that the Valencia service area does not have currently have a retail capacity fee, and there was some interest in that. So we've actually been doing some legwork to get started on establishing one, and I thought I'd just come in here tonight and give you a little bit of a background and a timeline for this project. Next slide, please. So here's what I'm going to go over. What is a retail capacity fee, and how is that different from a facility capacity fee? Why is there currently no capacity fee for the Valencia service area? How is this fee calculated? And what is roughly the project timeline? So we'll go through these. Before we go on to the next slide, I just want to call out that one of the things that as a starting point for our discussion on and our work on the capacity fees is to identify what are the objectives of establishing the fee. And there's a lot of different reasons why you might want to have one of these. One of them, which applies to us, is the requirement that development should pay its own way. That is, growth should pay for growth in our system. It helps fund major system expansions. It will help to minimize, reduce the amount of debt we would need in the future, and to equitably recover the capacity-related capital costs from current customers and future customers.
I got real quick. There we go. Let's go to the next slide. So everything with finance has a lot of terminology around it, so I thought I'd put a terminology slide out there. And you know, the starting point for us is always looking at the American Water Works Association. They're a 100-plus-year-old organization that has led the drive for unified understandings and discussion definitions of terms. And here's what's kind of interesting. A system development charge is a one-time charge paid by a new water system customer for system capacity. It's also assessed to existing customers requiring increased system capacities. The receipts from this charge are used to finance the development of growth-related or capacity-related water facilities and are an important funding financing source for these facilities. So there you go. That is the definition. They've called it a system development charge. But what you'll see below is a bulleted list of what other agencies may call it. And highlighted there is capacity fees. So here at the Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency, we'll be referring to this development of a system development charge as a capacity fee. And it will be charged to developers either for new expansion or increased capacity within the existing service area. Let's go to the next slide, please. A little bit of repeating myself here, but basically, again, it's a one-time charge paid by a new water system customer for system capacity. So I've got two examples here, and they're quite different. One is for new development, the fee is a buy-in to existing local infrastructure that serves as the connection to the regional water supply. The second example would be where in an area where there currently is an established development and an established system, the fee is triggered when an upgrade in service meter connection size is requested. And a couple of examples of this is if you were to convert a warehouse to a brewery, it's common that the water expectations and needs for that type, those two different businesses are very different. There'd be a need for an increased meter size. And so there would be a additional use of capacity. So there would be a capacity fee charged to that developer. Another example would be if an existing in a strip mall, if a existing tax service moved out and was replaced by a restaurant. Very different water usage. And oftentimes there would be a need to increase the meter connection size there. So there would be a capacity fee that we would collect on that. Let's go to the next slide. Here's a big question. Why is there no capacity fee currently in the Valencia service area? And this is a little bit of history. Pre-merger, the Valencia Water Company funded local distribution infrastructure projects from capital investment of owners by ownership. The ownership received a return on this investment in the form of a dividend generated from their retail rates. Now, the Castaic Lake Water Agency, now the Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency, purchased the assets of the Valencia Water Company. The agency's business model is that growth should pay for growth. So therefore, establishing a capacity fee is a leading practice to achieve this, and this is what we are going to be working on. Next slide, please. So the agency currently has capacity, distribution capacity fees in the Newhall service area. There's actually three of them. The column going down on the far left of that slide. Then on the far right, you'll see the green titled table. That's the Santa Clarita service area. And in between those two is the Tesoro Developments. There's two. And I also want to call out in our service area, the Los Angeles County Waterworks District 36. They have their own separate retail connection capacity fees, but they do pay a regional facility capacity fee when it's when they're going to connect to our larger backbone to the system. Let's go to the next slide. That's just a visual, a graphic of our service area. Basically, the color coding there matches up with the table of existing retail capacity fees that we showed on the prior slide. Just informational purposes, no need to spend much time on that one. So let's go to the next slide. How's it the capacity fee calculated? There's generally three approaches. One is the equity buy-in, which is based on the existing system's value. Another approach is called the incremental cost, which is based on the value or the cost to expand the existing distribution system. And then there's what they call the hybrid or a combination of both of those. There's different reasons for using the different approaches. We're not sure yet which approach we'll take. We are in the process of bringing in a consultant expert to help us with this determination and the actual calculations of the fees. Let's go to the next slide. Potential issues. There's always some good issues to be aware of when we're starting these types of projects. Basically, the first bullet there says you also need to start with take a look at any applicable current legislation or laws related to the capacity fees and make sure that we're going to do the calculations that are defensible and in accordance with the existing regulations. Then we've also identified a couple of unique things that are we will be looking into a little bit more. You'll recall, some of you may recall that the Castaic Lake Water Agency, Newhall Land and Farm, had a 2012 settlement agreement. And there was a couple items that are mentioned in that agreement that we'll be taking a look at to make sure that there are no relative issues that might get in the way or impact our calculations for this capacity fee. Let's go to the next slide. So here's the estimated timeline. This Thursday, the request for proposals will be published, and I believe it'll also be published in the Signal newspaper. We've got a June deadline for the submittals to be received, and we will be coming back July 18th to the F&A committee with the proposed selection. And then a board, take that to the board for an August 2nd approval. We anticipate starting the work August 3rd. We will be doing the study, stakeholder communications with the Santa Clarita Valley Economic Development Council, BIA, and the F&A committee several times during this, this work. The idea would be have the work completed at the end of December, come back to the F&A in January with a final presentation and recommendation of a fee, and then take it to the board for a decision in February of 2023. So there's the timeline, and this is something that we've been talking through and working on a bit. So if there's any questions at this time, I'm happy to take note or concerns or comments. It would be interesting. Otherwise, we will see you back with this topic probably in a couple of, in a month or two. Thank you.
Great. So this is not an action item, but do we have any comments from the public?
We do not have any public comment at this time.
Yeah, and this was just a informational item here, Director Kelly. There was no intention on taking this to the board for further presentation or discussion at this time. This was just to tee it up with you folks.
Well, we know how energetic the public is asking questions. I'm just making sure. Any committee member questions, answers? Yes, sir. Director Colley. Okay.
Just didn't want to go first if Director Martin wanted to go first. So first, a comment. Generally, I think as this agency is getting much more mature, an equity buy-in approach is, as I think I've mentioned before in similar discussions, generally my preference. But what I'm trying to figure out is, are we trying to get to a specific Valencia charge, or, you know, my preference would be to get all of the historical agencies and both the historical retail and the historical wholesale fees, get them all wrapped together and have a single fee. So let me ask the question, what is your thinking initially?
The initial thought on this was to close the gap and put one that's Valencia specific, and then we can then work on unifying. Perhaps we'll take a good look at do a study on unifying a retail capacity fee across the entire service area. We can also take a look at that time if it would make sense to include the regional assets as well. But that's just something that we definitely thought of, and we're interested definitely in looking to how we can streamline this into a single unified rate across the entire area.
We stress again and again that we no longer are retail and wholesale, that those don't exist anymore. We've bundled everything together, and there's no longer. And so to create a brand new, never before seen retail charge seems a little, I don't know, seems problematic somehow.
Well, I appreciate the comment. That's something that we can definitely take a look at and think through as we start teeing up this work. The intent was initially just to close the gap on the Valencia service area that had nothing, basically a stake in the sand, as we've done on some of these other things to improve. But yeah, it's probably, it sounds like it'd be something that we should be looking at, and also a goal for definitely to achieve to get there at some point.
Okay. What, I mean, if we had an attorney here present, I'd put him on the spot and ask the question if we could simply take a board action to say something along the lines of no development will occur without paying the minimum of whatever existing charge is right now, and you know, do that tomorrow. And then pay a whole lot of money. Like, it sounds like we're going to be paying a whole lot of money for a very temporary fix. And my preference would be to, if we could, just to take a board action to fix the current problem with a temporary Band-Aid, saying something along the lines of their, you know, whatever minimum charge that the legacy agencies had, everybody pays at least that minimum. So I don't know if that's possible, but then I would like to spend the money on the consultant. My preference would be to work towards a single equity-based fee for historical retail and wholesale, or this new merged agency where we don't differentiate between the two. So if we can sort of think about heading in that kind of a direction rather than paying couple hundred thousand dollars for a consultant to put a Band-Aid on something that I'd like to get fixed soon thereafter anyway, because I'm not real thrilled with our current facility capacity fee, as you probably know. So I'd like to consider a lower cost approach for the short term, if that's possible. Thanks.
Thank you. We'll look into that.
Thank you, Director Colley. Director Martin, any questions?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Kelly. Mr. Campbell, are we saying in this proposal or this informational item that we're now in the fifth year of SCD Water and the entire Valencia division has avoided the same kind of capacity fee increases that other divisions have or have been charging?
Yeah, the other divisions have a retail capacity fee. The facility capacity fee, which you have for the regional, right. Everyone's paying for that. But yes, you are 100% correct. The Valencia service area today does not have a retail capacity fee charge for development.
And this is, I appreciate Director Colley's characterizing it as a brand new, never before seen charge. But this is a one-time charge if you increase, let's say, the meter on your facility. If you have a greater water use and therefore you have to jump meter sizes, you don't not only pay the increased connection fee for the meter, you pay for a capacity increment, a one-time charge.
Yes, this is a one-time charge.
Okay. I suppose it's not possible to know the magnitude of charges that have been avoided in the last, in this being the fifth year of the agency, but it seems reasonable to me to do this, depending. But I guess my concern would be, is it possible to bring it into alignment with the other divisions that are charging a similar fee, such that we're all using the same methodology and we're acting like a one agency instead of a bunch of divisions acting. Go ahead.
Our chief engineer looks like he wants to comment. He might be able to answer some of your questions.
Yeah, thank you. Some of the things we have to do on these, on our capacity fee studies, we have to make sure that the numbers are based in reality. They're based in the actual facilities in the area that is served. So we would have to do an analysis of all of the system, and we are currently doing that. We're in the middle of a master plan. We've issued the RFP, and we're selecting that consultant. One of their first order of business is to determine our future projects for across the valley, both the regional and retail projects across the valley that are necessary, so that we would understand the full scope of expansion and projects that are needed, in addition to the replacement and upcoming maintenance items that we would have. All of those factors are going to be included in the next capacity fee, which you would want to look at for a valley-wide. It's good to have that updated model to understand the full scope of the costs that would go into those capacities. And that's where you would get into whether or not you would do a buy-in or equity or a combined approach, where you actually look at the potential for expansion due to regulatory needs or additional items that require expansion of some of our facilities, or do we just pay for buy-in of existing facilities? So those changes will be looked at in future reports, but as a stopgap measure, we wanted to make sure to not have Valencia continue to move forward without having a fee. So we're going to look at those from an existing asset perspective and present that to the consultant and have them prepare a report. It won't be as extensive as across the whole valley, so hopefully the costs will be manageable from that consultant, but we'll see when we get the bids back on the level of effort they determine.
Thank you, Courtney. Appreciate that. I don't have any other questions, Director Kelly, or Chair Kelly.
All right, great. So with that being said, you'll doctor this and bring it back for another exposure in the future?
Yeah, so we'll definitely take your comments and concerns to back and continue to get this evolved.
Great. So moving on to item 7, presented by Rochelle Patterson, recommend receiving and filing of the 2021-22 third quarter financial report.
So this is the year-to-date through the third quarter, which is March of 2022. The companion piece to this report is the statement of revenues and expenses, which is on page 47. And we'll be looking at those year-to-date comparisons. The first item is the water production and sales. Year-to-date total water consumption was 47,476 acre-feet, as compared to the budget projection of 41,755 acre-feet. Our total water sales revenue for the quarter were $16.1 million. Overall, the year-to-date revenue of $66.4 million is an increase of 8% from the $61.7 million budget projection. Our overall revenues, which is our operating and non-operating revenues, is $95,076,887, and we're 2% over the budget of about $92.8 million. Significant changes in the year-to-date charges from the budget. Water sales were the largest one, 8%. And of course, it's residential, 17%. That is a majority of our customers. We also, through March, have added 590. These are revenue connections, different from facility capacity fees. These are actual connections that are new to our service, so they are considered billing connections. Our property tax, the 1% received in the third quarter, was $4.7 million for a year-to-date total of $16.4 million out of the $17.2 million budget. The facility capacity fees received in the third quarter were $1.2 million for a year-to-date total of $5.8 million. Our total budget for the full year is $6.8 million, so we're nearly there with 3 months left in the fiscal year. And then you can look on page 36 of the packet. You can see where the fees were collected from what developers and the number of connections in the third quarter and the total year-to-date number of connections. Our other miscellaneous revenues, which include grants, reimbursements, sale leases, rental income, investment revenues, received in the quarter were about $5 million, with a year-to-date total of $6.4 million. That is approximately 92% of the budget of $7,051,000. We have our investment maturities by fiscal year. So as of March 31st of 2022, the agency has approximately $218 million in short-term and long-term investments. Our long-term investments are about $62.9 million, are held in various federal agencies and certificates of deposit. Our annual yield is about 1.74%. As our investments do mature, we are able to invest in some higher interest rate yields. So that will be a good thing. Our capital improvement program, the fiscal year 21-22 PAYGO budget was a total of $47 million. We've spent about 28% of that, which is about $13,130,000. We do have about $4.3 million in additional committed costs, so that is looking to go up. And for the debt-funded budget for 21-22, it was $25.6 million, and of that, we spent about 30%, and that equates to $7.7 million, and there's about $1.2 million outstanding still in committed costs. For our operating expenditures, we are at a total of $57,142,000. We are under budget by 8%, $5.2 million of the $62,378,000 budget. Some of the significant activities, several of the departments were under budget. One of the departments with over budget was management, and that's primarily due to perchlorate litigation costs. Under budget were source of supply, where additional water purchases through banking programs have not been realized yet. And also we have some core water supplies, which are paid in December of June, but are budgeted evenly throughout the year. We are under budget in water resources, primarily due to conservation programs that were less than expected due to lower program participation, but hopefully in the next few months, we will see some more participation in those programs. And under budget in our pumping wells and storage, which just is timing of PFAS resin changeouts and some Edison invoices. For our debt service in the third quarter, we made some interest payments on the agency's debt in the amount of $3.2 million. And the total principal debt outstanding as of March 31st, 2022 is $280,289,000. There is a new section in the monthly financial reports we will get to in the next item. Also, you can see the list of our total PAYGO and debt service projects or debt projects and on page 40 through 42. If you want to look at them individually. And that completes my report for the fiscal year 21-22 third quarter financial report.
We have any public comment?
We do not have any public comment at this time.
Committee members? Director Martin?
I just thank you, Rochelle, for the report. Appreciate it. On the CIP that are trailing in actual versus budget, I assume Courtney is going to be catching up on that pretty soon. Okay. All right. Thank you. I have nothing further.
Dr. Colley? Move forward to consent. And we'll continue with Rochelle's parade.
So in the next section, I'm going to bypass page 47, which is a statement of revenues and expenses, other than to say there was a year-to-date increase in net position of about $29 million, but that's primarily due to the PAYGO being under budget. There is a new page in here, two pages that you haven't seen previously. It's page 51 of the packet. We're calling it the debt and cash position. We get questions quite frequently about our outstanding principal debt. So we just we will be updating this section every month. And it is just reporting the agency's outstanding principal and debt service on an annual basis, our cash balances of unrestricted, restricted, and reserve funds, as this one is as of March, and the total current and non-current assets as of June 30th, 2021, which was our last audit report. On our first graph, the total outstanding principal debt as of March is the same $280 million as previously reported, with an annual debt service of $32,917,000. This outstanding principal does not include the Valencia Water Division acquisition interfund loan, which is noted at $63,411,661 principal balance. On the table at the bottom is the cash position. This is our total cash. Later in the report on page 67, it has a list of all of our cash and investments, which total $293,993,000. And it's broken up into these three categories. We have reserves of $111 million. Our restricted cash is $113 million. And that restricted cash includes facility capacity, or retail capacity fee funds, state water project funds, and any remaining bond proceeds we have from the 2020A bond issue. And then we have unrestricted cash of $69.5 million to meet the agency's current payment obligations. And then on the next page, this one won't change until our next audit. We just wanted to note what the total capital assets, net of accumulated depreciation, and the current cash assets as of the last fiscal year. And then further in the report, you will see the cash and investments and a list of all the investments and where they are and their yield. And I'd be happy to answer any questions on this section.
Once again, any public comments?
We do not have any public comment at this time.
Committee, Dr. Conley.
So, yeah, this is a number I'm not sure I've ever seen before that I think is pretty interesting. The capital assets net of accumulated depreciation. So, I guess, can you tell me a little more on how that was derived? I mean, I don't think I've seen that number before, have I?
It's a number in the audit report, and it's listed in all of these. So these are all of our capital assets when we combined the agencies, when we merged the agencies. We have a total assets of $766 million net of accumulated depreciation. So when we value all of our assets at the time they were installed, that's the amount that that's the total of our assets combined.
Okay. So it may or may not be an accurate picture of kind of our net worth. So for example, a well-built pipeline likely is going to last 100 years. If we depreciate it over 50, at the end of the 50 years, which we actually do have pipes in the ground, they're 50 years old. They're not valueless because we're still using them. So our net, So this is not a number that I could lean on to say that this is what, if somehow or another we were to want to sell this agency, which is of course absurd, a willing seller and a willing buyer would probably pay something significantly more than that $750 million, right?
I think our capital assets are just over $1 billion.
Okay. So the reason this number sort of is interesting to me is that some number like that could be used if we had a really good number that was similar to that number of their net value, you could divide that by the amount of water that would be delivered by that system. And then you could charge somebody, a developer. The divisor would be pretty simple to come up with. If the number in the numerator was reliable, then we could develop facility capacity fees off of that number. But that's one of the reasons that's kind of interest to me. So, yeah, I appreciate it. And I appreciate this this new data, because it does help to, you know, everybody knows that I'm concerned about debt, but more important than debt is sort of your, the way I look into my personal life is that if I cashed out, okay, if I sold my house and my cars and paid everybody back and whatnot, what would I have in my pocket, so to speak, on the day I die, perhaps? And if that's a positive number, I guess I'm doing well. And if it's a negative number, maybe I'm not doing as well. So this data helps me sort of understand and put the debt into perspective. When you also look at our assets, and particularly cash on hand, I'm assuming that none of this cash position includes any money that we're just holding for developers, right? If a developer comes in and asks engineering to design a new water system for a new development, they pay a fee for that. But we don't call that our cash until we actually expended it. We're just in a...
No, it is. It's
cordoned off.
Deferred revenue, unfunded revenue. There's different terms for it, but it's more of a liability. Because we will either, once the facility is built, then it will come over as an asset. If there's any remaining money, then it gets refunded back.
Right. So yeah, that money that we're holding for a developer to fund the engineering studies or whatever it is, presumably we don't put it in our cash position, but I don't see that in here. So yeah, I appreciate this new data. That's kind of my conclusion.
Director Martin.
Thank you, Chair Kelly. Rochelle, I do appreciate also the new data you've given us, and it's helpful to paint a complete picture, but I have no further questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. So are we flipping a coin? Who's doing item 9, Eric or Rochelle?
Item number 9 is the committee planning calendar. And I just wanted to point out a couple of things coming down the road for us that are kind of interesting, good topics. The June 20th committee meeting, a couple of items that we've been asked to spend some time with you folks on is discussing our project timelines and assumptions for rates and fees. We've made, you know, in all of our rate studies, we've created and documented some of the assumptions, and people have asked, how are those holding up? On the 20th, we will also be looking at item number 64, I want to call out, review the status of the Finance and Administration Department's strategic goals. That's another item that we have been asked to bring forward and just talk about. And then finally, an item of interest at the July 18th committee is to have another discussion around the long-term financing for capital assets. This is something that it's going to take the work that we did with this committee back a few months ago, and it will be baked in with our ongoing discussions with the engineering folks on identifying the costs that are realistic for a certain timetable, and what are the sources available for funding them. And there's grants, there's state revolving funds, there's WIFIA loans, and there's cash, there's also your standard revenue bond. So we will be taking a look at all of those items and coming forward for a discussion where we can hopefully narrow down and pinpoint and start really anchoring down our next look at a financing plan for the next few years. Big discussion. Thank you.
Going back to item 8, did we
acknowledge that's going on consent calendar?
I think so.
Yeah. Okay. So item 9 is taken care of. So once again, Eric or Rochelle, item 10.
I have just one general report. We've been working on for almost the last year the upgrade to our CIS, so our billing program that our customer service department uses, where we're integrating and upgrading the Enquesta system, which now we have two systems. We have North Star and Enquesta. North Star is the Santa Clarita Water Division, and Enquesta has Valencia legacy customers and U-Haul legacy customers. That is now being upgraded and it's anticipated to go live. So we will have one billing system in Enquesta for all customers. So that's been a big lift for our customer service department, and that should be going live at the end of this month.
Great. No other comments? And it looks like item 11 says we're in adjournment. Thank you.
Thank you.